the technical net. We get so share the responsibility. We get so share the responsibility. That's how it works. And you'll hear tonight whether or not anybody's left on the EZOT, but everybody go to the Jason Hamvention. We'll soon find that out. And we'll also find out whether or not the Epic, who is looking at with a rusty eyes at a set of any particular network analyzer, did he finally buy it? I hope he did, and if he didn't, I'm going to go half with him on that if he's a little bit too expensive. Hopefully he wrote down the call list, the name, the phone number of the guy. If JD signs in tonight, we're going to give him a suggestion on his hex beam. He wants to have his hex beam on the chimney, and he's afraid the chimney might not be able to tolerate it. There's a technique I know by which this chimney could tolerate something 10 times bigger than that. We'll get into some of those details, though. But it's that we always teach each other. So lots of learn about wireless equipment. Stand by a minute. Yeah, wireless equipment has... Guess this is a better way to get in. Wireless equipment has a lot to be learned about it. The books do a fairly poor job, in my opinion. The schools do a fairly poor job of really explaining. You want a wireless engineer, somebody who understands antennas and knows how to design them, you'll hire a ham radio operator. You would value to hire somebody who is lucky enough to work for a company that does that kind of work, and he's got a 10-year apprenticeship. It takes about that time to learn. There are 5,000 kinds of antennas. You have any doubt of that? You take a look at the fourth edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by the Lattice. And you look at those 50 separate chapters and the 50 separate subsets, and you'll see what the adapts and kinds of antennas look like. Lots to be learned about all this. And Jack Bruce eats Sunday night, and we teach each other. That's how it all works. A person signs to the technical net by giving Paul, John, and Dick the call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for net. Need that sign in just because you're listening after 30 years of the technical net. This technical net, number 1,450 of the series that began in September of 1982, way back in the dark ages. But I always believe somebody to listen. It doesn't have to be talk to us anymore. And notice that the next net, let me talk to you. In those days, the technet used to last for 1 hour. Pretty soon, people started complaining there wasn't enough time to get their questions answered. It became 2 hours, and then 3 hours, and for the last 4 or 5 years, it's been 4 hours. Starts at 8 o'clock local time and ends at midnight. And I sort of forced it to end at midnight because some of these guys, because such enthusiasm, they go until the sun rises. And some of these guys have got to go to work the next day. The last 6.5 years of the technet are all recorded, and you can go to a website where you can read, you can play back all of those 6.5 years of recording by going to amateurradio.tangolipter. Mike Perry, TQNJI, has done that thorough job of recording all those. You select the right year, the right month, the right week, the right hour. You can download one of those 1 hour reels, and there are people who do that. They put that out on their iPod or other kind of recording device, listen to that jazz as they drive to work in the morning or on the train. So there's ways you can hear the technet, even if it goes beyond the hours in which you can stay up that late because you've got to go to work the next morning. Let me drop the call. So there's other ways of getting the information. With all that kind of wireless equipment to learn about, if you think that you've got a dumb question, don't worry about it. The philosophy of the three of us is there's no such thing as a dumb question. It's called dumb question really means that there's a larger gap between what the guy knows and what he would like to know. Therefore, it's the question most deserving of an answer, so don't worry about that. During the first hour, we take people's call letters, name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment for the net. Let me jump back. We take that particular piece of information at least a preliminary answer to their particular question. After the end of the first hour, approximately that, John goes to the mailbag for those who don't yet have their ham license or don't have the right equipment to sign into the TechNet. The TechNet is a live question and answer period at the time. None of us per se are promising a free consulting written service during the rest of the week. That's above and beyond the call of duty. The 4 hours we put in each Sunday night is more than enough. So at the end of that hour, for those who don't yet have their license, don't have a way of signing in, they give John a snail mail, an email, or whatever. And we select two, three, or four of those that have a general kind of information to them. And John will read us those questions, and we do our best to answer those. The TechNet is not all, the smarts you're hearing on the TechNet is not coming from those three people. We're trying to tap into the fact that there's a huge brain power that exists in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, which this repeater covers. Now, by way of EchoLink and IRLP, we're now getting inputs from much further distances. We're now finding out that there's a lot of brain power in the Golden Horseshoe of Canada. And V3ZTZ, V3JIW give us the benefit of their wisdom. And there are other people from time to time who will sign in by the various techniques and giving us their experience on the subject being discussed. Everything you hear on the TechNet is not necessarily in the job. Everything you hear on the TechNet is not necessarily 100% accurate. Nobody's asked 1,000, and we don't claim that. However, there's a kind of peer-reviewed technique taking place here. By way of the recordings on the amateurradio.tv, when any of us makes a major error, somebody will inform us about it real fast, and we make corrections. So ultimately, you hear reasonably accurate information. The first time you hear it, there's no guarantee that the price is right. We're going to take check-ins at this time. Give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. T2LIW listening.
NTRDB, Tim, yes, the question.
We certainly got you, Tim. Next person to sign in.
WS2N4, this is Search Report 6. Good evening to you.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing from you, Paul. And as you probably know, something terrible happened to the Kepler Space Telescope this week. And we're hoping it's going to come back to life. Make sure this is turned off. And is that one turned off? Yes. We're hoping it's going to come back to life. It lost one of its very valuable gyros. So hopefully you'll be giving us that information, Paul. Alrighty, we've got Tim and Paul. Anyone else deciding? Give me your call letters and name. Try to prove to us that somebody has left on the East Coast. Not everybody went to a Dayton convention in Dayton, Ohio, where I hear tell that something like 30,000 amateurs were there. Anyone else left on the East Coast area? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW.
DMC, Eric, no.
We got you, Eric. Okay, Eric with a no. Anyone else? Give me your call list and name right now. K2LIW.
Is DMQ Neil? Yes.
Okay, I got CMQ and Neil. I'm guessing it's KC2CMQ. Am I correct on that one? That's a pure guess on my part. Over to you, Neil.
Kilo Delta 2 CMQ.
Okay, Kilo Delta 2 CMQ. We got you, Neil. And one last call. Anyone else to check in with a real question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW in the text mask. Okay, one other thing I should mention is that, as you know, there is a disruptive person in the New York area who would like to disrupt the signal. And as such, when you hear noises that you think should be there, don't tell us on the air what you hear. Tell us by way of RFI dot amateur radio. Here we go. RFI at limarc.org. By signing into RFI at limarc, LIMARC.org, carefully note the time. Give us a more accurately the time and whether or not you heard is on 146.8525 or on 147.375 or 975. Tell us what frequency you were listening when you go to the reverse mode and how strong was the signal. What did it sound like? So give us that report and that'll help us track down this individual who takes great pride in being disrupted. And by the way, sometimes the signal on your input frequency, when you go to the reverse mode on your radio, is going to be a very weak signal. And I've got a couple of guesses as to why it's such a weak signal and where he is located. So if you go to the CW mode of your radio, you're listening to the tone and the noise. That gives you an extra 15 decibels of sensitivity. You may have to do that if you've got an all-mode rig. Go to the CW mode, tell us what it sounded like. So, once again, that's at RFI at limarc.org. Okay, Tim, go right ahead with your question. And to Romeo Delta Bravo, if I got you right, Tim, KQRIW in the segment.
Yeah, you got it right, Dick. And I'm always glad that this net is here every Sunday night. It's always for interesting listening. Anyway, an antenna question. I will first mention my wife and I went to see that new Star Trek movie today, Into Darkness. If anyone listening out there plans on seeing the movie, and if you have the option of seeing it in 3D, spend the extra few dollars. It's worth it. Anyway, that having been said, I was checking out a website, WHJI.com, where WHJI composed a design for a so-called Windham antenna, actually an off-center fed dipole, where he feeds it at 80 and 20% instead of one-third and two-thirds. I'll let it drop a moment. So anyway, he feeds it at the 80% and he calls for a 4-to-1 current balance at that feed point. But then he says at the end of his article, almost as a parenthetical remark, that the antenna works better if fed with ladder line, 450 ohm ladder line. Now, I was wondering, if you did feed it that way, and then put your 4-to-1 balun further down the line, say closer to your transmitter, would then that ladder line not become part of the radiating antenna? I was wondering if you could offer any feedback on this.
Yes, I can, Tim. First of all, it's hard to believe, but a dipole does not radiate the signal you give it immediately. We all would like to believe that we're launching some signal out of our transmitter, goes down the transmission line, hits the dipole, and as it goes down the dipole, the signal just jumps into space. That's what we all would like to believe. If you start digging deeper into it, and the book does not properly explain this, you really are feeding a flywheel. You get the information about what the dipole really does in a very left-handed manner. They tell you it's a standing wave structure. They tell you it's got a Q of 10 or 20. But this is hidden language. In other words, the signal that you apply to that dipole, it slows down the dipole, goes to the open end, and only 5% of it approximately radiates on the first pass. 95% or so of the energy is left over, it hits the open circuit end, and reflects back. And we resonate our dipole, we resonate our antennas, because we know the energy is going to bounce back and forth 10 or 20 times, and we want all of those bounces to stay in step with each other. That's the definition of resonance. I'm amazed the books don't explain it that way. So you're really feeding energy into a flywheel. Only 5% of it's going to be radiated on each half pass, so to speak. You resonate the structure, and I'm now talking about electronic resonance.
Yeah, the simple way to resonate is to make it the right length. But if you wanted to make it shorter or longer, let's assume that you're going to make it shorter, and you're going to make up the extra length electronically. You're going to put a loading coil at the bottom. You're going to put a top hat capacitor at the top. You're going to zigzag it. You're going to use helical winding. Or you're going to put an antenna tuner near the antenna or at the other end of the feed line. And if the feed line is low enough and long, like ladder line is, you can get nice. Time we drop out, make sure you listen for the four beeps like I wasn't doing, otherwise you time out the machine, and we should listen 1 or 2 seconds beyond the four beeps to make sure that everything gets reset so the guys out of the area can hear it. So if the feed line is low enough and lost, that's the magic of open wire line, whether it be 300, 450, or 600 ohm ladder line, it can tolerate extremely high standing wave ratio, but still having very little loss. That gives you the ability to put the antenna tuner in the shack. It doesn't have to be at the antenna because the feed line is so low and lost. And what resonance means is that all the bounces in the antenna are going to stay in step with each other. They're going to stay coherent. And when you're resonating the antenna, you're resonating the radiating structures, plural. Radiating structures mean antenna, balun if there is one, match network if there is one, transmission line, and the antenna tuner, the mic is in the shack, and the final tank circuit of the transmitter. You're going to resonate that whole structure in order to make everything resonant. Now, once you recognize the fact that the dipole itself is like a flywheel, you're putting power, you're putting energy into that flywheel, and it's sort of like pushing your daughter on the swing. You can do it with your finger. As long as you do it with the correct timing, she builds up a very nice, large deflection on the swing, even though you're putting in very little energy on each half cycle. Can you drop? Now, once you realize that you're putting energy into the flywheel, you can do it with a push rod that's near the pivot point or near the perimeter of the flywheel. You know, don't have a push rod you've got on the great big driven wheel of a locomotive, you know, a railroad engine. You're putting energy into that flywheel. That's what the dipole really is. Once you realize that, you realize there's absolutely nothing magic about feeding the dipole in the center. If you've got the right kind of an impedance matching device and the right kind of a balancing device, you can feed it in the center, you can feed it 10% off to one side, 40% off to one side, and the thing that I've been advocating a lot lately, for the few people who have done it, and we first got the clue about this from Bell, KUKEY, he set up a full halfway dipole, which is a vertical piece of green wire, strung in the evergreen tree out in front of his house in Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, and he fed it from the bottom. He fed the open circuit end of the dipole. Yeah, you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance, and it requires an L network, an inductor, and a capacitor to step up the impedance. When you do that, once you're smart enough to know that once you impedance match it and you feed the open circuit lower end, it becomes a very simple antenna. You don't have to put up a whole bunch of ground plane radials. A simple ground rod serves as your counterpoise because you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance. You feed the open end at the bottom, and you get extremely high performance out of that antenna. In the ideal world, it would be nice to have a balancing device to make sure that there's no common mode current flowing down the outside of the transmission line. Yeah, when the transmission line is back in the center and it's off to one side, you do have to worry a little bit about current flowing on the transmission line. And now the transmission line becomes part of the resonance of the antenna. Let me drop. So now the transmission line becomes part of the antenna. If there is no balancing device, when you're feeding it off to one side, the transmission line does become part of the radiator. Now the length of the transmission line will make your antenna act a little bit above or below the resonant frequency. And now the pattern becomes a little bit more complicated. It's not a showstopper, but the ideal world, you'd like to have a balancing device when you're feeding it off to one side. You don't have to do that when you're feeding it at the lower end, at the open circuit end, because usually you've got a ground rod that you're feeding it against that becomes the counterpoise. But almost any other place, like using the open wire line, in the ideal world, you'd like to use a balancing device. If you don't, Now the transmission line is going to do some of the radiating. That's not necessarily bad, as long as that transmission line is not running alongside of the apartment of your neighbor and giving them some television concerns. Because anytime you've got common mode current flowing on a transmission line and it's doing the radiating, and if it comes close to some piece of electronics that your neighbor is running, like their television set, their telephone, their phonograph, or whatever, there's a chance you're going to have some electromagnetic interference. So once you realize the physics of what's going on here, Tim, you can feed it anywhere you want, you can feed it any way you want, and you can make it fly. I know this is not the whole story, but maybe some of it helps. And two, RGB, wait for the three beeps, K2RIW in the text net.
Yes, that is somewhat helpful. So the fact that one would use rather ladder line to feed it, it would be less lossy than coax cable, but then you you have to insert a balancing device at some point, and that the line itself, the feed line, would actually radiate to some degree. Okay, very good. I saw the design, and as I said, it's set at the 20%, 80% point, and his claim to fame with it is that it covers most of the bands from 80 through 10, I think with the exception of 60, 17, and 12 meters. So, that's something I was interested in playing around with. Yes, thank you. You gave me some helpful pointers there. N2RDV.
One of the main advantages why people seek the Carolina Wyndham or the Wyndham antenna is that it does work reasonably well on multiple bands. Another very, very effective way of working in multiple bands is a so-called fan dipole. In other words, if I took an 80-meter, 40-meter, 20-meter, and 10-meter dipole, and 15-meter dipole, and fan them out a little bit, and connect them all in common at the center, and feed them at the center. The magic of the way an antenna works is that becomes an absolutely automatic switching network. When I'm transmitting on 80 meters, the 80-meter antenna presents a 73 ohm impedance, and 98% of the energy going down that feed line will go into the 80-meter dipole. The 40-meter dipole is a 1,500 ohm impedance, almost an open circuit, so is the 20, the 15, and the 10. All the other dipoles, if you're feeding 80 meters down there, are almost an open circuit. Only 1% of the energy goes down there, then another 90-some-odd percent goes into the right one. It becomes an automatic switching network. So the so-called fan dipole does a beautiful job of giving you an extremely predictable impedance on each one of the bands, and giving you multiple bands that you can use simultaneously if you wanted to. You could, if you wanted to, if it was legal during the contest, transmit a CQ at 80 meters and 20 meters simultaneously with that fan dipole fed in the center. So that's another approach that you might want to consider. Let me drop for a second. My goodness, is that not enthusiastic? So there's lots of ways to feed your dipole. And feeding in the center, feeding it at the fan, feeding it off to one side, feeding it at the open circuit end, and toggle. Adrian's got a look. He's got a look in the transmission line. You can feed almost any dipole on any frequency you want and do all of the feed matching in the shack. The only thing wrong with doing the feed matching in the shack is that if the dipole itself, say for instance an 80 meter dipole and you're feeding it on 40 meters, you do that, you're going to run into a 40 to 1 standing wave ratio. Under ordinary circumstances, a 41 standing wave ratio means that your transmission line would have a tremendous amount of loss. If it's open wire line where the loss is so low, it doesn't matter. And if your antenna tuner in the shack has a large enough dynamic range to it, you could feed your dipole on any band, any frequency you wanted to, as long as the antenna tuner can handle that higher standing wave ratio. It's a resonant circuit, it's a flywheel, and there's lots of ways you can get the energy into it. If you've got a wide enough dynamic range, feed the matching device in the shack, you can do that. So an awful lot of things that you want to do, once you're smart enough to understand the physics, you'd be amazed how much you can get away with. As you go further downrange with this experiment of yours, Jim, as you experiment with either your Wyndham dipole or your fan dipole and your open wire line and the right kind of an antenna tuner in the shack, and you start measuring the impedance, you start measuring the performance and find out when the drop. But you find out from the guys you're talking to what kind of signal reports you're getting and what kind of DX you're getting. As you do this experiment, please report back with us periodically and let us know how it goes. When it comes to antenna experimenting, that's where we amateurs really shine. Very few of us these days on 80 to 10 meters build our own rig. On 10 gigs, yes you do. But on the 80 to 10 meters, with a week's salary, you can buy something that would take you a year or two to build. You spend that year or two and you're going to own it for the rest of your life. It's a homebrew rig. You buy the right rig that's got a good track record with a 1 or 2 weeks worth of salary. If you don't like it a year or 5 years from now, quite often you can get 75% of your money back by selling it on the flea market, if you know what I mean. So used equipment. I'm a big enthusiast of used equipment. Almost everything I own is used because with people like Andy from the HCDO around who can fix anything, as long as the thing, even if the rig has been thrown down a flight of stairs, the front panel is dented, as long as 90% of the electronics in there is still there, you can make it work, and you can save yourself an awful lot of money. The rig you're listening to right now, for instance, my Kenwood TS711A, is an oldie but goodie. I think it's a 1989 vintage. And that period of time, somewhere around 1989, let me drop the call. And it's a 2 meter all mode rig with one of the world's best frequency synthesizers. It only has 30 or 40 memories to it. Doesn't have all the latest horns and whistles. Does have a tunable IF strip so you can tune it up to work.
Thank you.
chest. I'm trying to do something a little more stealthy. So, you know, this is part of this is to solve landlord problems. Oh, and I'll let it drop for a moment, and I'll tell you about that hamstick dipole project. Yes, very good. You might remember about a year ago, I came to you asking about fashioning an NVIS dipole type antenna from a pair of hamsticks. I actually joined two pair of hamsticks together on 80 and 40 meters, and I suspended them about 14 feet in the air, basically hung over my landlord's balcony railing, obviously when they weren't home or when they weren't around to see it. And by putting 10 watts into it, I was basically, I made some interesting contacts in upstate New York, in Canada, in Pennsylvania, in Missouri. The guy in Florida didn't hear me, but the fellow he was talking to in South Carolina heard me like gangbusters. Ohio, several in upstate New York, and parts of New England. So, that antenna was a success. I'll let it drop a moment. Considering that I was using 10 watts of power on single sidebands to do my work. So, I would say that was a success. It tunes, or let me put it this way, it resonates on most of the voice portion of 40 meters, and it resonates on the uppermost portion, very narrow swath, about 25 kilohertz, on 80 meters. I can bring the rest of the band in with the tuner, of course, but the project was a success in my estimation. N2RDB with K2RIW.
Okay, I guess you passed it back to me, Tim. I wasn't sure. So it's almost a hamstring back to back. I did the job very nicely. Almost any piece of wire. Long, short, zigzag, helical round, or whatever. With the right kind of impedance matching network, be made to resonate on your frequency. And we can really take that to the ridiculous extreme. You'll start studying the appropriate chapter of the Bible on the antenna, which was by John Krause, WHJK, the head of the electrical engineering department at Ohio State University for a whole lot of years. He wrote this beautiful book in 1950, published by McGraw-Hill, called Antennas, the Real Bible on the Subject. And there's a chapter in there, a very significant chapter, called the Infinitesimal Dipole. You take your 80-meter half-wave dipole, 132 feet long, and you start shrinking it shorter and shorter, physically, making less and less wire in there. And making it up by loading coils, top hat capacitors, zigzag, helical winding, antenna tuners, and whatever. As long as you bring it back into resonance, you can make the dipole extremely short. Probably you could make it 15 feet long instead of 132 feet long on 80 meters. And once you resonate this, it's going to be very high in Q. It's going to be very narrow band. QSY more than 20 KC, and you're going to have to retune your antenna tuner. It's going to be very high in Q, narrow band antenna. But at its resonant frequency, within half a decibel, it'll give you the exact same gain as the full half-wave dipole. When it comes to receiving, it will have within half a dB the exact same effective capture area as the full half-wave dipole. Of course, that defies common sense. That's the magic of resonance. As it gets shorter and shorter, it becomes As it becomes shorter and shorter, it becomes a higher and higher Q resonance. But once it is resonant,
it brings back all of that effective capture area. It brings back all the exact same pattern. And the next step of understanding that is that your dipole is 70 feet in the air, 60 feet in the air, and it's directly parallel to the Con Ed wiring or the Long Island Power Authority wiring is directly across the street from you, directly in the direction that you want to talk to that guy in London. And you think that, boy, that wiring is going to shadow the living daylights out of you. Absolutely not. 98% of the time, that wiring of Lightbuck is not resonant. That 80-meter dipole of yours, whether it be full-size length or not, as long as it's resonant, has 8,500 square feet of effective captured area. That non-resonant wire of the Con Ed wiring casts a shadow of a couple of square feet onto your antenna, and your antenna is 8,500 square feet of effective area. You won't even know it's there. Yes, if there's some arcing on that wiring, you're going to get some electromagnetic interference. And it may require a darn good antenna blank, a noise blanker to live with it. You'd be amazed how many guys who think that, gee, that wiring across the street at the exact same altitude is going to kill my signal transmission and reception in that area, in that direction. Absolutely not. So once you understand the magic of resonance, once you understand effective capture area, once you understand that you can feed it anywhere you want, as long as you're smart enough with impedance matching and imbalancing, there's lots of ways you can feed the energy into that flywheel called dipole, and you can make it radiate 98% of that energy into space where you want it. Then the only thing left to discuss in that situation is how far above the ground is it, because the ground reflection is going to affect your vertical takeoff angle. And in the best of all worlds, you'd like that takeoff angle, let me drop it. You would like that takeoff angle to be as low to the horizon as possible, because when your radio signal is bouncing off the horizon at a very shallow grazing angle, you get two or three benefits. Number one, you get a much bigger reflection. Number two, it goes much further on each individual bounce. It takes less bounces to get from here to London or here to South Africa or wherever you want to go. And so you get a stronger signal, you get a smaller number of bounces, and you're going to get less QSB, you're going to get less noise in many cases. So the lower the takeoff angle you can generate, the better off you are. With a horizontally polarized antenna, low takeoff angle requires many wavelengths of altitude above the ground, because that ground is a mirror reflecting that signal. But if you go to vertical polarization, where the ground reflection is not out of phase like it is with horizontal, it's in phase, a vertical dipole, and the nice thing about feeding the bottom of a vertical dipole is you can get some more altitude out of the thing. It's easier with your physical methods of mounting it. With the phase center is farther above the ground, you're going to clear the local terrain, the trees, the buildings a little bit better, and you're going to get a lower angle of radiation. But those guys who build a pure vertical half-wave dipole and feed from the bottom, they say quite often, why in the world hasn't somebody told me about this earlier? We amateurs have a lot of fun out of experimenting with antennas, and that's what you're doing, Tim. I know I'm branching off into a couple of other subjects, but I thought you'd like to know some of this jazz. And two, RDV. The guy who's doing all this antenna experimenting in Mimeola, T2RIWNTechNet. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, it's very good, Dick. Stand by one moment. I'm going to let it drop. Yes, very good. Well, basically, ever since I ran into this landlord problem, it's become a quest to find the best solution around it. And I'm actually on very friendly terms with them, and I hope to keep it that way. So basically, I had put up several different designs, and they kind of have accepted that, oh, Tim's running one of his experiments again. So we've sort of reached the status quo. Now I just have to get them to let me put up something permanently. Hi. Anyway, I'll tell you, between listening to this net as a resource, and then, of course, I asked questions of Mike, WY2U, Mike Cosma. And, yeah, I've been learning some really interesting stuff about this. Am I anywhere near close? close to an expert in the field? Absolutely not. But it's just an area of interest of mine, and I'm tinkering around with it. And yes, your information has been extremely helpful. Feel free to digress all you want. Into RDV in the next.
Hey, Jim, you got it made. You've got friends around that are going to give you hints. You have direct access to Professor Mike Cosma, WY2U. Okay, so he's got a lot of antenna experience, a lot of physics experience. He teaches the subject in college as an occupation. I do the equivalent of teaching antenna technology to some degree by way of the TechNet. And using what I've learned through ham radio, through my 40 or 50 years of ham radio experience, is where much of my antenna experience has come from. And the net result is that with my consulting business, one of the clients I work with, I put my name on quite a few of his antenna patents for the antennas that allow him to run his business. And so one of the kinds of antennas you're going to be hearing more about in the future is something called a beta material antenna, where you synthesize dielectric materials that have properties that the real world doesn't have. Very similar to what the guys in solid-state physics, the guys in the physics world are doing. They're synthesizing brand new elements, brand new atoms with higher and higher atomic numbers. And well, there are people synthesizing brand new antennas that have much broader than normal bandwidth by way of metamaterials, and I've got involved in a little bit of that work. Some guys in the future, I'll be telling you guys more about it. Okay, Tim, thank you for signing in, and come back and let us know how your experiments work. And I think my understanding, from what I'm hearing, Tim, your landlord is slowly realizing he's supporting a very good effort. You're not hurting anybody. And although he's got his rules you've got to live with, I think he's not going to give you very much grief. I think you're eventually going to get what you want. Now, the next guy was Eric. It is KC2. Wait a minute. I've got to repeat this. I can't even read my own list of deal. KD2 at CM2. He lives in one of those very rare towns called Glen Oaks. Bet you he's close to the theater, and I bet you he's going to get through very well. Go right ahead, Neil. KD2 CM2, K2LIW. Sorry, kept you waiting.
I'm actually surprised my grandchildren don't receive the repeater on their braces. However, I had a question about feedline. Now, as far as my research shows, the best way to use a coax feedline is to make it a half wavelength minus the velocity factor. My question is, since I only need about 40% of that length to get to the antenna, how's the best way to store the rest of the coax cable? I'm afraid if I wrap it in a, you know, wrap it up in a loop, I'm basically going to create a choke, which may not be a bad thing, but then it will be it won't count as part of the length electronically of the feed line. Is that making any sense? Over.
From one point of view, Neil, it's making a lot of sense. Another point of view, I've got a very interesting story to tell you. You have been responding to what I call an old wives' tale. You tune across the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, you'll find a significant number of people telling you that your feed line must be a half wavelength long, an odd number of half wavelengths long, an even number of quarter wavelengths long. They'll give you all kinds of stories. There is no magic blend of a transmission line. Think about it. In the case of the 14-layer printed circuit board that's in your cell phone, there is a real transmission line from that printed circuit board to the antenna that's at the bottom of the cell phone. Nowadays, the antenna is at the bottom, very close to your chin, for a whole bunch of reasons. They move it further away from the eye. So it's at the bottom of the cell phone, but the transmitter might be at the top. And that transmission line inside of your cell phone is probably a 16th of a wavelength long. That's not a half wave. There is nothing magic about the length of a transmission line. There is an interesting piece of mathematics that happens at a half wave.
when you're an even number of electronic half wavelength long of transmission line, the magic of a transmission line is that whatever load impedance you've got at the antenna, the transmitter will see exactly that load impedance. So it repeats impedance in half wavelength intervals. By the same token, if you're using a slotted line, and you suddenly realize that all the peaks and valleys on the slotted line fall exactly a half wavelength apart, a half wavelength apart on the slotted line. If again, it's an impedance repeating phenomenon with a drop. And if you wanted to, you could use a quarter wavelength of transmission line. A quarter wavelength of transmission line, or an odd number of them, gives you an impedance inversion. 50 ohms at the far end will be 50 ohms at the near end. But if you go to a 2-to-1 Biswas, 25 ohms at the far end, you'll see 100 ohms at the near end. You still have a 2-to-1 Biswas, but it's impedance inverted. Low on one end becomes high on the other end if it's a quarter wavelength long, or an odd number of quarter wavelengths long. They get an even number of half wavelengths long, 50 ohms at one end is 50 ohms at the other end, 25 ohms at one end is 25 ohms at the other end. It repeats. The next question is, well, gee, what happens if I go halfway between quarter wave and half wave? And the answer is you start acting reactive. You put a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on the end of a 3/8 wave transmission line, for instance. You're still going to see the exact same standing wave ratio at the input end, but you're going to be on the opposite end of the Smith chart. The Smith chart is this polar chart. The dot somewhere on there represents your exact impedance and its reactive component. And you swing from the center of the Smith chart to the equal distance on the other side, and that's the new impedance you're going to have if you have some other crazy length of transmission line. So the transmission line itself, when properly used, will take every bit of the energy you put into it and deliver it to the other end. What impedance you see on the input end is a function of what impedance you put at the far end, and how that impedance is reflected. This law is preserved, but the exact impedance changes in funny ways when you have different lengths of transmission lines. So don't fall into the trap when you drop. Don't fall into the trap to think that the transmission line must be exactly a half wavelength long, or a quarter wavelength long, or 3/8 of a wavelength long, or any of these other numbers. There's nothing magic about those numbers. Yeah, life becomes a little bit simpler mathematically when you have those numbers. But the transmission line is not going to blow up and catch on fire and do something bad because you have some other length. Use whatever length of transmission line is convenient for you. In the worst possible situation, if your particular antenna on some particular band you want to use it on has a rather high standing wave ratio, and now the antenna tuner in the shack runs out of range with that higher standing wave ratio, in that particular case, you add an extra hard length of transmission line between your antenna tuner and your feed line. You now rotate to a different portion of the Smith chart, and where your antenna tuner used to be out of range, half of the time it comes back in range. So in one case like that, with very high standing wave ratio, for your particular antenna tuner and your particular crazy impedance of your antenna, yes, there may be a magic length of transmission line that makes it work. And another example is, every so often your solid-state brick amplifier, your 2-meter amplifier in the automobile, but certain lengths of transmission line takes off an oscillate. Let me drop and explain that one. That beautiful quarter wave or 5/8 wave 2-meter ground plane mag mount on the top of your car might be an extremely desirable impedance at 146.85 megahertz, for instance. However, at some other frequency, like 100 megacycles or 220 megacycles, it's almost a dead short or an open circuit. It's some other crazy impedance. The nasty thing about brick amplifiers, bipolar in particular amplifiers, is that the transistorized final stage is broadband as all hell. It's looking at all the possible frequencies that antenna can possibly operate on. It finds a short circuit on one of those frequencies. It decides to oscillate on that frequency. And sometimes it's very hard to kill that oscillation. By changing the length of the transmission line, you now suddenly make an amplifier that used to be unstable with that antenna become stable. So in that case, there's some magic length of transmission line. So the guys who have an unstable brick amplifier in the car, they went to the antenna corner, they went to a clinic where Andy DeBate, CDL, is using his service monitor, he's using the spectrum analyzer. He finds out, yeah, the guy is transmitting on 146.25, but half of his energy is also on some other crazy frequency where it's oscillating. And there are cases where you change the length of the transmission line and the whole system suddenly becomes stable. So there's a couple of crazy examples, but for what you're doing, there's nothing magic about half waves. I know this is going to sound a little crazy the first time you hear it, because you've probably heard lots and lots of guys say the other theory, and it's not based on very much fact, in my opinion, Neil. KD2, CMQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, it kind of made sense to me having the wavelengths cross the zero point at the connection, but you know, that's why I'm asking, because I felt
repeater timeout,
and I've got a bunch of extra feed line. Is it the best way to make things kind of neat by wrapping the feed line in a loop with a couple wire ties? Or is there a better way, say, just let it kind of be random on the floor? Over.
There was a timeout, but for those who missed those 2 seconds, we didn't miss anything. I'll fill in the point. The only reason why I would worry about wrapping up an extra length of transmission line, as I see it, Neil, is because I've got this length of, let's say, FM8, or I've got this length of some fancy kind of transmission line. I can't even think of the model number right now. The model 400 stuff, where there's a beautiful set of connectors on the end. I don't want to cut the cable. I want to use it as is, and I've got an extra 30 feet left over between the antenna and the shack. And so the magic of coaxial cable is that every bit of that signal, 99.999% of it, is all inside that cable. What you do on the outside does not matter. The RF does not see that, with one slight exception, and that is if you've got an unbalanced antenna system. In other words, you didn't bother using the balance. You can
LMR 400?
That's what I was trying to think of, LMR 400. Thank goodness. Let me drop. You've got this very expensive piece of LMR 400 with these expensive connectors on the end, and it happens to be 30 feet. It happens to be 30 feet too long. So in that particular case, you don't want to cut it. And what do you do with the extra 30 feet? Whatever you want to mechanically. Wind it up, hold it together with scotch tape, with paper tape, with ties, wraps, whatever. The only reason why you do something fancy along those lines is that if you're feeding your dipole antenna without using a balancing device, you've got the center conductor going to one half of the dipole and the shield going to the other half. The dipole itself is, let me drop. The dipole itself is a thoroughly balanced antenna. It wants to have half the voltage on the right side and half the voltage on the left side. It will try to balance itself, even though you think you're feeding all of the power with the center conductor to the right side. Therefore, it will generate some energy on the left side of the dipole. It will feed some of the energy down the outside of the coax cable, and that's the so-called common mode current problem. Now, what you think is your dipole, you think that's the radiator, it happens to be the dipole plus the transmission line. So your antenna becomes more complicated, perhaps something else. And if you now take a few turns of your coax cable as an RF choke and hold it together with tape, tie wraps, or whatever, right at the antenna, now the RF choke on the outside of the cable by way of the turns buys you some benefit at that location. But in the shack, extra length of cable, you can zigzag it across the floor, you can make it into a small coil, a large diameter coil, whatever you like. All of the RF energy, if you've got a well-shielded system with properly installed connectors, all the RF energy is on the inside, and except for that crazy dipole situation with no balance, there is no RF on the outside, and therefore what you do with the outside of the cable doesn't matter. You've got complete choice on that. Does that make a little more sense, Neil? KD2CM2, K2LAW on the tech man.
Test deck, it makes perfect sense. Thank you very much. That actually, I don't have to spend so much money on coax cable. I had one other real quick question for you. I'm going to be using a choke valve, you know, 20 feet of wrapped up coax on a 4-inch piece of plastic tubing. Would it make any difference if I put non-conductive, in other words, just for the sake of neatness, if I put it, or put the pole through it, if I was using a non-conductive pole, would that interfere with the inductance and make it a different kind of inductor? Again, I'm talking about 20-some-odd feet of coax in a tight wrap on a 4-foot, or rather, I'm sorry, a 4-inch piece of a PVC pipe, and then through the middle of that would be a non-conductive prop, say a 2-inch PVC pole with some wood in the middle of it to give it some strength. Over.
And you want to know, can you do that? And the answer is yes and no. If you're intentionally making a RF choke right at the dipole itself as a poor man's balance, you're going to put 3, 4, 5 turns of coaxial together with the tape tie wraps or whatever. You're intentionally making an RF choke, and you want to make inductance on the outside of that cable so that the RF energy sees that RF choke, sees a high impedance. And how much impedance is it? It's inductor reaction, X of L equals 2 pi FL. Twice pi times the frequency times the inductance in Henry. That's the amount of inductive reactance. And how do you know how much inductance you're going to have? You go to the appropriate chapter of the radio amateur handbook, and it tells you that if you have this many inches of diameter and that many turns with that much spacing, you plug in the numbers to the formula, and it tells you how many microhenries you're going to get. And once you know those microhenries, you look up for your particular frequency, you find out how much inductive reactance you're going to get. It's all quantitative. So there, you're intentionally making an inductor as an RF choke right at the antenna as the poor man's balance. In that particular case, I would not recommend putting metallic objects in the middle of that choke because it will lower the amount of inductance. However, for your convenience, down in the shack, where you're not doing it for RF choking reasons, you're only doing it because, let me drop. You're only doing it because you've got some extra coax left over and you want to conveniently tuck it somewhere. In that particular case, whether you wrap it on wood, polyethylene, PVC, steel pipe, whatever, doesn't matter. Because all the RF energy is flowing between semiconductor and the inside surface of the outer braid of that cable. That's where all the RF is. There's no RF energy on the outside of that cable, and what you do with it